It's what we would call a chamber opera, which is, not only chamber in the size of the cast, it's a small cast, it's a small orchestra, but also the duration is, I mean, it's a very.
Steve Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet, WFPR.FM, and in the local Franklin, Mass. FM radio dial 102.9. Here today in the studio for a special discussion, and for the listeners, I just came from a finance school committee discussion. Now I'm going to talk about opera.
Wow.
There's a bit of a range there, but this is going to be fun. So, John Mitchell, welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Really, I'm as pleased as punch to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you because opera, this is my first discussion on an opera. So we'll get into that. But we also have Luis Viquez.
It's great to be here, Steve. Thank you so much.
Excellent. So first question for me is, other than the date and the time, clearly for those who are not aware, June 9th at the First Universalist Church, you're going to perform this opera.
Yes, that's right.
For
June 9th
time.
At 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock, and I think there's a kind of a preview at 2:30 or
something
indeed. Like that.
Oh, indeed. We've got a marvelous preview here. We've got David Fostovsky, who is a dinosaur expert. He's a paleontologist.
Ooh.
Just retired, I guess, a couple of years ago from University of Rhode Island.
Okay.
So he'll be, I guess he'll be giving details about dinosaurs, and he's also very familiar with the characters that are in the opera, because those characters were real people, and so he's familiar with paleontology, I would say, in its nascent stage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, way back in the 1820s, 1830s.
From a historical perspective, historical reference, yes, these are real people, and obviously they may have done some, and that's where he can add to, they did this discovery, it led mm-hmm. to this, etc., etc., so that's fascinating.
No, it really is, and it is something that in one aspect fell into my lap, but in another aspect did not. And the genesis of Mary Anning Fossil Hunter would go way back.
Okay.
To
that was going to be my question. So why all of a sudden an opera about this lady, Mary Fanning, from the 1820s? That's a long time ago.
Well, indeed it is. And it turned out that my son, David, David Edward Mitchell, he's an author.
Okay.
And he has written several short stories. Some have been published. And he's also written a novel. And he had been working on a novel having to do with the Orkney Islands north of Scotland there.
Okay.
Okay. And then he became interested in William Buckland. William Buckland was a dean of Westminster and also an unusual character in that he ate his way through the zoo, so to speak.
He ate his way. Wait a minute. When you go to a zoo, there's animals there. So now he was eating animals?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. That may or may not be appetizing for some.
But he was also a biologist, and he called himself an undergroundologist.
Undergroundologist.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yep. In other words, kind of a paleontologist. Okay. So anyhow, my son was doing research on Buckland. And in 2019, we went to Oxford University, which has a great free natural history museum.
Okay.
We also went to Salisbury Cathedral, saw the one copy of the Magna Carta, went to Stonehenge, wonderful area.
Yes.
And then we went to the coast, to Lyme Regis. And David had already known about Mary Anning, who was this fossil hunter. We would call her an early paleontologist at this point, and we went to the Mary Anning Museum there. We actually did a little bit of fossil hunting ourselves on the beach, and so we had a great time. Well, when I got back, 2020, COVID.
Oh, certainly.
COVID hit?
COVID changed a lot of lives.
Right, right. Now, I'd been retired from University of Massachusetts Boston since 2015, but I was still active, and my wife, Esther, and I were doing a lot of traveling in those 5 years, and this just all of a sudden put the whammy on everything.
Yes.
And so I had a friend, and still have a friend, I should say, Paul D'Angelo. Paul and his wife, Elaine, who will actually be playing flute on this production, close friends of ours. Paul, in retirement, and he's a few years older than I am, was writing this grand opera called Daughter of the Revolution. And he had, I mean, this was huge, just something like Wagner combined with Verdi, perhaps just this, all sorts of instruments and everything. So he was writing this, and I thought, you know, maybe something can happen with this material from Mary Anning.
Okay.
And Paul asked me, he said, well, you know, are there any conflicts here? Can you make this into an opera? And I thought, perhaps I can. So there are five characters in this opera. Mary Anning, and let me read a little bit about Mary to you here. She's the central figure in the opera.
Sure.
Born in 1799, died in 1847. She was a formidable force in the early years of paleontology. She was born in Lyme Regis, and for all practical purposes, spent her entire life there. Okay? She was the daughter of a cabinet maker. She had only a minimal formal education. Okay? And yet she became self-educated to the degree that she was able to converse with the leading geologists and paleontologists of her time. She was a spinster all her life. She had an unyielding dedication to her pursuit of fossils and often was not given credit for her discoveries. That would be putting it mildly.
Well, in that stepping back, way, way back, this is 1820s, 1830s, etc. England clearly was a different place, never mind the world, but women still did not have the rightful place that, to a certain extent, they may still not have it today, but they've made a great deal of progress. But at that time, there were things that they could not do.
Right. And so Mary could not do this in two steps. Okay. For one, she was of the quote-unquote lower classes. She was of the working classes. Even though her father was a cabinet maker and not, say, a coal miner or whatever, this was still the working classes, of the British. And so she had that to overcome. And then, of course, the fact that she was a woman, anybody involved in really any type of professional existence, anybody that was involved in all this would have been men.
Yes.
Okay? And there was no place for a woman, you know, at all. So, Mary did the best that she could with what she had. Now, on a lighter note, Mary may have been and was very possibly the source of the following well-known tongue twister. Are you ready for this? I'll probably botch this. We'll probably have to record this 15 times.
This is the glory of recording in a studio. You can take time and record because that tongue twister is a tongue twister.
All set? She sells seashells down by the seashore. The shells she sells are seashells, I'm sure. So she sells seashells on the seashore. Then I'm sure she sells seashore shells. One mistake.
Not bad for a first go, but I'm sure you've had a little bit of practice as well, although not immediately.
What's really fierce is that we have a chorus who sings this.
Oh, that should be delightful.
And fortunately, you know, the music flows along at a pace such that it shouldn't be too problematical for them.
Oh, good. Yeah.
And they don't have to sing it all the way through. Certain parts have, like, the first line. Others will have the second.
Okay.
You know, so it's not quite...
It's a little bit more of an elaborate production than the rhyme that, as kids, some of us remember and having getting challenged. And if you had troubles with S's, you just didn't go anywhere near there.
No, indeed. So that's Mary Anning. Okay, now another character is her friend Elizabeth Philpott. Elizabeth was actually 19 years older than Mary, though this fact is not important to the performance of the opera. Elizabeth and her sister had a substantial collection of fossils, which attracted many visitors to Lyme Regis. So a lot of what Mary collected ended up in Elizabeth Philpott's collection, and collection. You know, for selling.
Sure.
Okay, so we have these two. Mary is a soprano. She gets a soprano voice. Elizabeth is a mezzo-soprano, a little bit lower.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then Dr. William Buckland, who I had explained already. Buckland, born in 1784, died in 1856. He was a theologian, a paleontologist, and a geologist, and he became Dean of Westminster. His son Frank was just as much interested in eating his way through the animal kingdom as his father was, and some of his preferred delicacies are included in the aria Mice on Toast. Can you imagine this guy serving mice on toast to his students? You know, it's crazy. And all sorts of things happened with Buckland. His brother-in-law's horse died. He had them cut the tongue out of the horse and cook it so that he could experience the taste of mm-hmm. horse's tongue. Worse than that was when the Surrey Zoo, which was, I guess, not too far from Lyme Regis, the Surrey Zoo had a panther, and it died. They buried the panther. Buckland had them exhume the beast.
Oh, no.
And had them cut a leg off and make panther chops for him. So he could experience that, so he could taste that. So those are just a couple examples of, you know, what we've got going on with mm-hmm. Buckland, okay?
He can explore in that culinary world if he wants. I'm not sure mice indoor panther legs are something that I would want to put on my appetite. Thank you.
Indeed. But Buckland actually is a protagonist in this because he helped Mary a lot. In later years, which would have been like from the age of 30, Mary received a stipend from the British Geological Society, of which Buckland was either head or he was president or something or another. So she got £25 a year, which at least kept her eating potatoes for, you know, the rest of her life there with that. And Buckland had quite a bit to do with that.
She had some sustenance from the work she was doing.
Then there were three other male characters. One was Dr. William Conybeare. And Conybeare wore many hats. He was a rector. He was a minister at the town of Axminster, which is just up the cliffs from Lyme Regis. He wrote about many of Mary Anning's discoveries, but he didn't credit her. So he would write about, you know, the ichthyosaurus that she found, but didn't say that she found it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Then we get to Dr. Richard Owen. Okay, this guy, born in 1804, died in 1892. He had the longest lifespan of any of these.
Mm-hmm.
He was a comparative anatomist. He was a biologist and a paleontologist. He was also founder of the British Museum of Natural History in London there.
Oh, okay.
But he was known to be stubborn. He was responsible for passing on the misinformation that resulted in Benjamin Hawkins Waterhouse's famously incorrect dinosaur sculptures that are preserved at London's Crystal Palace Park. Okay? So, this saurus, that saurus. One that he had what should have been a thumb bone placed on top of its nose, for example. And Owen would be corrected on this, and yet he would still double down on all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so he was very stubborn. So Owen gets the part of the cowardly tenor in this opera.
Okay.
Buckland, I forgot to mention, was a baritone.
Okay.
Conybeare, bass, but Owen is the tenor.
Okay.
Okay, now,
so you've got a range of voices, male and female, mm-hmm. or of course the range of the scales, if you will, or the range of the human voice.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Well, there's one other person, and this is Henry de la Beche. Now, Sir Henry de la Beche, born in 1796 to 1855. He was a geologist and another paleontologist. He was also the first director of the Geological Society of Great Britain and eventual president of the British Geological Society. Okay, this sounds really remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing is, he grew up in Lyme Regis. And he and Mary, when they were teenagers, would go out together and hunt fossils and all this.
Mm-hmm.
They had a very close relationship. Okay? And it may have been somewhat romantic, but his family was of the upper classes. Okay? They owned a sugar plantation in Jamaica with slaves yet.
Mm,
okay?
Yes.
So they had their wealth from this.
Sure.
And any possible pairing of the two romantically, that was quashed by the family.
Yeah.
That was it, you know. Henry was forced to marry within his class a woman who I don't know if he loved her or not, okay? But his family forced him to marry her.
Just checked all the boxes within the class.
You bet. Mm-hmm. Well, she turned out to be unfaithful to him, okay? And so it turns out that Henry and his family, they were able to get a divorce, although the word divorce wasn't
fully accepted in the class society in those days.
Yeah, it was a little bit different. So a separation or a permanent separation or something or another. We could say an annulment.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, during the first act of the opera, Mary learns of this. And at first she's rather happy about this. But then finds out that Henry took off to Switzerland. He was so upset with everything. He just had to get away. Went to Switzerland on a dig.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so Mary has an aria at the end of Act One lamenting this. The chorus, which sings She Sells Seashells,
mm-hmm.
toward the end, Mary asks, "What will become of me?" And the chorus responds with this. So it's very poignant.
Seashells, yeah.
Now, Henry does not show up on stage until the epilogue of the opera, okay? And what we have is an actor, a person, an elocutionist, whatever word you want to use there,
mm-hmm.
standing at a podium, being the president of the Geological Society, being Henry, okay? And reading from the Geological Society's bulletin. Henry did a eulogy after Mary had died in 1848, and it was printed in the proceedings of the Geological Survey.
Ooh, so she got some recognition, finally, in terms of that kind of publication.
That was the first time any woman had been eulogized by the Society,
uh-huh.
and the first time that it was actually in print.
Right.
Okay. Some people would say this was perhaps requited of unrequited love. You know, that's going a little bit far.
Speculation.
Yeah, it's speculation.
Open to that, for sure.
Right, and yeah. I don't bring that out in the opera.
No.
But, you know, I mean, it certainly is a tribute.
Right.
To Mary Anning and what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary Anning, when she died, at 48. The average lifespan in the 1830s, 1840s in Britain was about 42.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, she lived a full life.
For that time, sure.
For that time, yeah. I mean, this is really something when you think about it. My gosh, what was I doing? What were you doing? What was Louise? Well, Louise hasn't been there yet. what were we doing at the age of 42? You know, it's amazing. And, you know, everything that has happened since then. So, I mean, this is really something to consider.
Mm-hmm.
And she died of breast cancer. I mean, wow.
Right.
This is really something.
Yeah, and especially back in that day and age, they didn't have the technologies and the medical treatments that are certainly available today. Certainly it may still, you know, terminate somebody, but there are so many options available for people to get help.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
So you've got a host of characters, but it's not kind of this big Wagner-esque opera.
No.
It's two acts.
It's two acts. We have a prologue, which is important. And this is, I mean, I couldn't have made this stuff up. In 1800, when Mary was 15 months old, her mother trusted her to a neighbor who was a nurse to take her to a circus that had come to town. Circuses, for what they were in 1800, largely horsemanship shows and,
sure,
and other things.
Traveling circus,
Ringling, yeah,
Brothers, Bonham and Bailey. It was a later iteration,
yeah,
of,
yeah,
the early days.
Yeah, so these are in the early days. And so at the circus, all of a sudden a storm whipped up and lightning struck this big tree. Okay. Well, the nurse and two other women were standing on an exposed root of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They were killed by lightning. Lightning struck the tree. They were killed. Mary, as a baby, was unresponsive. Her father had been at the circus. He was watching what was going on. He came, ran, grabbed the baby, took her home. Okay. And he and Molly, her mother, Mary's mother, dipped the baby in warm water, tried to revive her, and they did, and they were successful.
Wow.
So that's the prologue, you know, some 27 years before Act One.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of sets the stage for what follows,
mm-hmm,
you know, in that way. So we've got a prologue, Act One, dealing largely with Mary selling shells and learning about Henry and this type of thing, and Buckland coming visit her. Buckland was the one who gave her the information, and then he has this aria, My Son Toast, where he's, you know, singing about all this other
toast
stuff.
Yes.
And then Act Two is 1839, 12 years later, and Mary is still digging out fossils. By this time, she had found a complete ichthyosaurus, you know, a fish,
mm-hmm,
and a plesiosaurus, and several others, okay? And so she was an experienced digger, but she and Elizabeth open up the act talking about how Mary's discoveries have been usurped by others.
Yes.
Okay. And it turns out that later on in the act, Buckland and Conybeare and Owen all came to visit Mary Anning on the same day. And this is fact.
Mm.
Okay? So they all came to visit her. A storm whips up. I like the storms whip up all the time in this. But a storm whips up, and Buckland is with Mary and Elizabeth. They're talking. The other two kind of wandered off on their own. And all of a sudden, there were eddies that were forming, and they got cut off. And so at the very end, it's Mary's decision. Am I going to let these guys be thrashed by the waves?
Oh.
Or am I going to show them the way out?
Right.
So people are going to have to come to the opera to find out
to
what
happens. To find out what happens.
Right. So those are the forces. We've got those five soloists, and we have chorus. We also have eight instrumentalists.
Mm-hmm.
We have piano and string quartet, two violins, a viola, cello, string bass, a flute, and a clarinet.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, of chamber music proportions.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think they'll work very, very well. And should work in the venue very well.
It should. Having been there a number of times for Circle of Friends concerts, I know the hall is acoustically great.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm sure you'll be able to create the set, whatever, even a minimalist set with the trees exposed through the back windows.
Right, right.
I'm sure we'll give you at least that outdoor. It won't necessarily be a kind of a English coastline view, but there's trees, there's outdoor.
Right.
Well, what we've learned is that they have two very large monitors, I think at least 30 by 60 and
okay,
might be 70.
Yeah.
Okay. So on these two monitors will be scenes.
Ah.
You know, scenery.
To create,
you
know, that.
So it's interesting, though, the scenery will be in front of the action instead of in back, but,
hey,
you know it's that, going to work.
All that backed by the nature behind, so.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to seeing the place. I haven't been that much here in Franklin, so I'm very excited for the venue. And you know, now that you folks say that it's quite acoustically majestic, hopefully it will do some good justice for the music that we're going to hear on this.
Yes,
Luis is a marvelous conductor. Okay.
Oh, thank you.
He's at University of Rhode Island. I too am a conductor, but I felt myself to be too close to the material.
Okay.
So I didn't want to, yeah.
Having created the book, the libretto, I think is the formal term. Now
right,
you're
yeah.
stepping back and saying, okay, now you can do this because yeah. I'm just too close to it.
Well, I'll be fidgeting around.
I'm sure you'll be involved. I'm sure you
sure.
will.
No, and it's great. And one of the things that I'm most delighted to conduct, you know, as a conductor, I would do all the way from wind ensembles to orchestras to opera, but opera has been perhaps the one discipline on the field of conducting that I would feel the most attached for. When I was at the University of South Dakota and when I was doing my graduate education, so basically for the last 12 years, I've conducted at least one opera on each of those years, So it has been, the fact of having music, music, drama together, and then having this marvelous story of Mary
sure.
Anning, I think that that's what makes it so special. And from all the operas that I've had the pleasure to conduct, you know, many of them major productions,
sure.
The Fledermaus, the Magic Flute, major composers, but this is the first time that I'm having the experience to collaborate with a composer on a brand new production, because
mm-hmm.
this, as we said, is going to be a world premiere.
A world premiere of little-known work. Maybe it'll be as famous as the Magic Flute over time. Who knows?
You know, we hope so, and especially because if there is anything that we could do to Mary Anning, it's a little musical tribute. I mean,
sure.
knowing how she was a woman that on her own class, you know, she had, I mean, from the moment that she was a little baby, tried to fight for surviving.
Right.
And
right.
then
right.
struggling her entire life on a society in which, you know, as many parts of the opera would say that learning made her mad. Like
Richard Owen said,
Richard Owen gets to say that, you know, that she became a very sore person because of having access to education, which is what she was not supposed to.
Right.
And even though she never had a formal place to get training in paleontology, she had her own endeavor to go do her own research. And, you know, knowing that, and then on top of that, you know, put her, the major stone of cancer on her life. I mean, I think that it's, you know, for those of us who didn't know who Mary Anning was before, I think that, you know, this opera can be very transformative.
Mm-hmm.
And,
it'll open a door, literally, on a couple of aspects. Certainly people who want to do something new. Okay, this is a world premiere. People who like music, people who like kind of that smaller chamber orchestra type, people who have a little bit of drama. Okay, there's two acts with some challenges there. And then ultimately the story of Mary, to bring somebody into that and say, okay, this is the position in her day and time, and are we still struggling with some of those struggles still? So
absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that I love of this opera is, you know, the aspect of collaboration, you know, not only having a composer, soloist, an opera, a conductor, but also, you know, the happy coincidence that we had. So Dr. David Fastowski, he just retired from the University of Rhode Island, a friend of a colleague of mine, but
mm-hmm.
he also plays the French horn in the University of Rhode Island Symphony Orchestra,
okay.
which is the orchestra that I conduct. So it was quite a, as I said, a very happy coincidence because, you know, I mentioned David and I said, look, you know, I know you're one of the I know you're a leading paleontologist here in the region. You want to know what my next project would be? And I said, you know, I'm going to mention John about you. And we connected with each other, and we're very happy that he's going to go share a little bit about his knowledge about Victorian paleontology, which is actually what he said that he wanted to talk a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
He's written a book, Dinosaurs, a Concise...
Two books, I think, yeah.
Oh, two books? Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Dinosaurs, a Concise Natural History.
Yeah. That'll catch some kids' attentions, especially anybody. Yeah, absolutely. You know, kids love dinosaurs.
Yeah,
so.
No, indeed.
So anyhow, I mentioned that I went to Lyme Regis with my son in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
Since that time, they have erected a statue to Mary Anning.
Oh, okay.
A bronze statue.
Yeah. Well, you had mentioned she has a museum there, so...
Yeah, there's a museum.
But now they've gone further and put in a statue as well.
Right. They're starting to recognize that, you know, she's there.
Mm-hmm.
There has also been an unfortunate movie about her.
Oh.
Done by a British director who had an agenda, an axe to grind.
Uh-oh.
Which is too bad.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to go up against that movie, but this opera is factual.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Right.
It's trying to lend the truth.
Plus, it's all being spoken with music, which is great. And
yeah. In terms of the delivery process.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, and on terms of the music, it would be a quite interesting experience for the audience, because it's very eclectic music, if I may call it that way, John.
Sure, sure.
I mean, you know, this is the conductor analyzing the composer. So, you know, sometimes what you think as the conductor, when you see the music, when you read it, when you play it, you know, when you analyze it, you know, it's maybe a little bit different than what the composer thinks. But it's great to have the composer in hand that you can always go ask questions. But it's very eclectic music, all the way from tonal music, I would say from tributes to English folk song,
yes,
all the way to atonal 12-tone music. So there is a lot of variety in the musical language, and I think that it serves very well you know, this dichotomy of music and drama, that the music yet it helps to portray the emotions. It also doesn't get in the way to truly outline who Mary Anning was, which I mm-hmm. think that's the ultimate goal of
so
this particular opera.
It helps
opera.
To tell the story,
exactly.
As opposed to detract from
exactly.
the story.
Exactly, because like if you think, you know, even though, like if you think on operas, I mean, like even Verdi, even Wagner, I mean, like, yeah, the music has, I mean, the music is a character itself. I mean, it's not that in the opera, I mean, it's not that the music is taking away a lot from the story, which I think that it's a very sweet combination. It's a very sweet blending. I don't know. I mean, John, you can add a little bit more. You have put so many hours thinking of how you wanted this to sound. So.
Well, all of this, what you're saying, is certainly true. There's also an English music hall element to this, too. Not everything is so very abstract.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it's fun.
Right, yeah. Right. So you go from English folk songs, kids' songs to a certain extent, rhymes, and then raise their level and then throw some variety in there with the different voices, the instruments, to tell ultimately, you know, a historical story. That sounds like it's going to be a fascinating afternoon.
It sure will.
Well, it certainly will. In many ways, I think.
Yeah.
And in terms of time perspective, I think I've seen, so you got two acts, so they're not long acts, they're relatively short.
Oh, it is not a long opera.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, it's what we would call a chamber opera, you know, which is, you know, not only chamber in the size of the cast, you know, it's a small cast, it's a small orchestra, but also the duration is, it's a very... I would say that it's a very direct and to the point.
Right. It's bite-sized as opposed to being something you're really going to take an effort to get to.
Yes, exactly.
No, it will start at 3 o'clock. well, who knows, maybe 303.
303. Three-ish.
And I would guess it'll be done by 4:30.
Okay.
We will have a 15-minute
intermission between the two.
And since the time I wrote this précis, I composed a short overture.
Okay.
I felt it needed it. And then there's some scene-changing music.
Mm-hmm.
We have one of our singers, Emily Bieber Harris, portrays Molly in the prologue, and then portrays Elizabeth in the rest of the opera. And so we needed something to get her from being this old woman in the prologue to being Mary's friend.
Okay.
And so she needed time to, whatever's going to happen, whether it's a change of hats, whether it's a change of wigs,
whatever,
something or another. So we have to give Emily a little bit of time there.
Yeah, step behind the curtain, boom, magic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Cool, well that sounds good. So, First Universal Society of Franklin, Chestnut Street, 3:00, come at 2:30 to get the paleontology dinosaur preview. Maybe till 4:30, and you should have been entertained and informed.
And informed, yeah.
Yeah.
And aware.
And yeah.
And aware about, and becoming more aware about, you know, one of the greatest women in science.
Mm-hmm.
And I should mention, partially because it's partially funded by the Franklin Cultural District.
We always got to put those plugs in there, for sure.
Have to put that in there. And for that reason, there's no charge. It's free.
Ah, that's
We are accepting donations. If somebody wants to give us a $500 donation, we'll take it.
Or any denomination.
But, yes, of course. Anything at all. But it doesn't cost anything. So cost should not be a factor here.
Yeah. So just call it 2 hours of your time to be entertained and informed in a new arena, potentially.
Yeah.
So, cool. Yeah, I don't know, I'd have to look. I haven't heard of an opera being performed in Franklin, or at least in my reporting time period. Maybe something has slipped through. My radar is not perfect, but this at least is the first one I'm aware of, so that should be interesting, yes.
No, it's great. I've lived here, about 23 years?
Okay.
And I think you're right, at least in that span.
In that span, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been here 28 years or so, but my reporting time is where I, doing my citizen journalism piece from 2006 or so to current. In that time period specifically, you know, that didn't come across the radar unless I totally missed it, which is possible. There is a lot happening. Thank you both for taking time to share some of the story.
Steve.
Hopefully people will be, wait a minute, an opera in Franklin? I want to go. Well, yeah, do.
I should mention, too, that it will be videoed by Franklin TV.
Ah, yes.
But if you want to see it live,
that's
as it's
always
happening.
Better.
Yep.
Always better.
If you want to be part of history, come
the
to
the world
opera.
Premiere version of
exactly.
history. Absolutely.
Right.
Yes. Well, thank you again for doing this. And quick reminder for the listeners, we do this because Franklin matters.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.